Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Do you have any more local Black Lives Matter marches to report, Susan?
Yes, we do, and some real controversy from Nevada. As many of you have read in various newspapers, early in the morning of June 22nd, Jason J. Kruzik, age 51, died from a wound received from a taser shot by a Nevada policeman. Ursula Rudenberg called the Nevada police chief, Ricardo Martinez, who described the incident and the investigation that is being made about it, including the autopsy by the state medical examiners. We'll lead off the morning with that report, and I'm very happy that you're with us today, Gina.
Hello, Susan. It's always interesting in co-hosting our local talk show. But I thought you said we're covering the Nevada's Black Lives Matter demonstration on Friday, September 26th. Does that have anything to do with Kruzik?
No, but the Nevada police were in the spotlight of both stories. The Black Lives Matter demonstration was scheduled before the death of Kruzik, and Chief Martinez was invited to speak at the demonstration, but he didn't show up. And according to the Nevada Journal, there was a lot of criticism of the police department over the death of Kruzik.
Yes, I have read that in the newspapers.
I guess it's not surprising. That's why we decided to let Chief Martinez give his explanation first. Then we've invited Shannon Novak, one of the organizers of the demonstration, to describe it and tell us what issues the participants wanted us to bring up. Their concerns came before the tragedy of Kruzik's death, and she plans to explain them to us.
That's a little more controversy than we usually talk with on Local Talk.
Yeah, but even from the reading of the official Nevada Facebook page, I can tell there are real conflicts of opinion among Nevada citizens. And KHOI is the ideal place to air them and hopefully clarify things. Having listened to the forum scheduled by the NAACP with the Ames and the ISU police departments, I felt that the discussion of the training goals of the Nevada police would be a valuable thing to hear. Fortunately, there had already been a coffee conversation on policing aired on the Nevada Facebook page on June 20th. I pulled out about 7 minutes, which discussed how the police are trained and how they try to develop relationships with the community they serve. We'll wrap up that segment as we hear the reactions from Ms. Novak. I'm glad you were here with us today, Gina, because I think your perspective will be valuable.
I guess so, but I was looking forward to finding out how our town in our listening area will celebrate the 4th of July this year.
Well, we have that to look forward to in the second half of the show, along with an unusual garden tour from the past and a little nostalgia with Paul Wearson.
Okay, well then, let's get started with Chief Martinez.
Can you describe what exactly it was meant when they said he was wielding a sword?
It was a sword. By the time I came in, it was already packaged for evidence processing, so I didn't get a chance to see it. But in the video recording, it looks like a sword. It's pretty long. It's got the handle, and he was waving it around. It's pretty long. I don't know how sharp it was or anything else like that, but I think anyone looking at it would think it would be threatening.
He was going from door to door threatening people with it?
No, the original call was that he was walking around with it, waving it around, and he was banging on people's front doors in an attempt to make contact. I think we got two phone calls about what was taking place, and that's when our officers responded.
Did anybody tell you why he actually said he was doing this? Did anybody get that?
No. We've made contact with some witnesses, people that were in the area, the people that originally called, trying to get as much information as we could, but nobody made any contact with him or talked to him, and when we attempted to speak with him, he was incoherent and yelling, and we couldn't get any information from him.
Was the behavioral unit in Ames contacted? Because clearly this was somebody who was emotionally disturbed.
No, the officers handled the call when they were there.
Why didn't they contact somebody who was trained to deal with somebody who wasn't kind of normal?
Well, in this particular case, we didn't know where he was at, and so we were trying to find the person. By the time we found him, we could see him in a grassy area by the trailer court, and he was yelling and screaming and waving the sword, and we tried to communicate with him, but he was not responding to any questions.
How many times was he tased?
That I don't know. I haven't reviewed all the reports yet, so I'm not sure how many times he was tased, but he was shot with one taser, and I'm sure he was probably hit maybe at least a couple different times with the power that's in it. But that I don't know. It could be more, but I'm not sure how many times it was.
And is that eventually going to be determined? Because clearly that affects possibly his medical condition.
That's part of the investigation that we're conducting. We're looking at all the information that we have, and any other information that we can collect We'll put that in our case and examine that as well.
Can you describe what the investigation really entails? Is the state involved? What happens now?
We interview everyone that we can, people living in the area, people that called in, certainly our officers that were involved. Story County had a couple of deputies that assisted us with this. We'll talk with them and see what information they can provide. We'll compare all that information that we receive to our policies concerning use of force. And determine whether or not the officers were appropriate and what they did. We'll look at how they treated the man at the scene once they got control of him and how his behavior was.
Is there a body cam video of what happened?
I know the police officers had body cameras. I can't speak for the deputies. I think they did. And then we have them in our vehicles, but the vehicles were in a location that they would not have caught any of what had taken place.
Who is doing the investigation?
We're conducting the investigation.
Nevada Police Department is doing it.
Yes.
Are you concerned about the use of force here?
Well, I'd like to wait until we get all our information to make a full assessment. But just based on preliminary view of the body camera, I don't see anything that was done inappropriately. I think the officers responded as they should have. As soon as they had control of this man, we called for an ambulance to come and assess him, take a look at him. That's also part of our policy. Whenever we use a taser, we like the paramedics to come in and remove the barbs from the person.
Was there a doctor on duty at the Story County Emergency Center when the person arrived there?
I'm assuming there was. Normally, there's either a physician's assistant or a doctor that's on call.
But you don't know if there was or not at the time?
No, not specifically.
Has the cause of death been determined yet?
No, he was taken down to the medical examiner's office in Ankeny, where they'll conduct an autopsy, and I think that's going to take place sometime next week.
You will possibly have an autopsy report and an investigation report by about when?
Depends how long it takes to get the autopsy report, and typically in these type of cases, there'll be a testing of the whatever was might have been in his system, whether it's medication or drugs or whatever, so we have an idea of the toxicology that was on him at the time.
When there's a serious case involving any sort of violence, whether it's against a policeman or by a policeman, usually the state does investigate. So why in this case isn't that happening?
Well, I've made contact with DCI, and we have discussed that. I'll probably hear from them a little later and they have to decide whether or not this is something that they would investigate or not. At this point, I do not believe that there is any type of foul play or any type of criminality that's involved, and we're looking at this more of an administrative point of view.
If somebody is killed in connection to a confrontation with the police, the state doesn't necessarily automatically investigate.
Well, if somebody is killed, that's different. What we have here is we have an unexplained death. He was tased. The person was taken into an ambulance to the medical center where he passed away. Now, exactly where he passed away and why he passed away, I don't have any of that information at this point.
If somebody dies in connection with a contact with the police, it's not necessarily an automatic reason for the state to get involved.
Normally, somebody like that will get involved. I've been in contact with the Story County Attorney's Office, and we've discussed this. And I know they're making some inquiries, so I'll probably have more information later. But at this point, I know that the DCI is probably not going to be getting involved in this case.
Because the cause of death isn't really considered related to the incident?
Well, I don't know that because mm-hmm. I need to get the autopsy and the toxicology back to know that. Then I have a better idea of why this person passed away, and then the medical examiner can let me know what their opinion is. If the state examiner says that there's something that needs to be investigated, that's going to be investigated. But at this point, I don't see that as something that's going to actually take place.
Does he have family in the area?
Yes. He was identified by his sister later that morning.
So you're in communication with the family?
Yes.
Why is it necessary to tase somebody in a situation like this?
Well, when someone is in this particular situation, carrying a sword around in the middle of the night, yelling and screaming and trying to get into people's homes, that's something that we need to investigate. We just can't let this person go about doing what he's doing. We'll get continual calls, and eventually someone may get hurt. So, you know, when we have to locate this person and find him, you know, one of the first things we're going to do is assess exactly what's taking place. You know, in most cases, we'll find that out. The person we're interviewing will tell us what's going on, what's taking place, and we'll try to provide any resources that are necessary to help him. But we didn't get any of that in this particular situation.
So you feel that in this circumstance, it was justified to tase him?
Yes. We'll investigate this. We'll get all our information together, and we'll figure out exactly what had happened, and we'll put out an official statement at a later date.
For those who just tuned in, we've been listening to Nevada Police Chief Ricardo Martinez describing the events of the night of June 22nd, when Jason Krusik died after being shot with a taser. Our next guest is Shannon Novak, an organizer for the Nevada Black Lives Matter demonstration held Friday, June 28th. Hi, Shannon, for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You were one of the organizers. Who were the other organizers?
It was just me and my friend Hannah. We were the main two who wanted to organize this conversation with the public.
And what is the racial makeup of Nevada?
It's 94% white. And the last 6% is a mixture of Black, Latino, Asian.
So what were the issues you wanted to bring up?
I wanted to talk about the racial bias when it comes to our police when they're making their arrests and pulling people over. I wanted to discuss police brutality, racism in Nevada, and how that looks throughout the schools and the activities that the kids are going to. That type of thing. I really wanted it to be just an open conversation. I wanted people to come and share their experiences in Nevada and kind of share what they have seen, because it happens a lot in Nevada, whether people want to admit it or not.
Did you have a lot of Black participants?
I honestly did not have as many as I'd like. The actual event, I think two Black people came, maybe more. I'm not 100% sure. And as far as people who were behind the scenes, I didn't have as many people come to me. I made a few posts on Facebook just letting people know that they can talk to me about what they're going through, but people weren't kind of biting at that as much as I had hoped.
Well, then if Blacks were not coming forward to talk about it, how did you know what a problem it was?
Because I can pay attention to the internet and what's going on, and I know that it's happening here.
So what were your hopes for the Black Lives Matter demonstration?
I was hoping that the police would come and show solidarity with us. I think if the police had came, I would have had a bit more support from the town.
As I was looking through the internet, I discovered that there had been a community conversation that is a monthly event that's sponsored by the city council. And there'd been one on policing just on the 20th, so just before all of this happened. And I excerpted about 7 minutes to play. On the other hand, this did not have anything to do with race. It's what their training is. And in Ames, where we have the NAACP having forums like this with the ISU Police Department and the Ames Police Department, they talked quite a bit about training. And so I had wondered, but maybe training was the problem. So let's listen to the 7 minutes, and then you can comment on what you think you've learned from that. Okay?
Okay.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us for our most recent community coffee. I am pleased to be joined with some representatives from our public safety department. We're going to be talking about community engagement. We had Rhonda Meyer on last week talking about what our Parks and Rec department has been doing with community engagement. And so this week we're continuing that discussion with public safety. So we have our Director of Fire and EMS, Ray Reynolds, Sergeant Chris Brandis, and then also have available Public Safety Director Rick Martinez.
I think one thing that we really emphasize, especially during our initial training with FTO and throughout the year for the officers, is to get out and talking to people. You could train somebody on how to do a lot of different things as a police officer, but it's hard to train somebody to just have a conversation. So the best way to do that is get out and talk with people. The businesses along 6th Street, we encourage this year with the construction and COVID, it kind of makes it a little hard. But to get out and go in and introduce yourself to the business owners, make sure everybody knows who you are and knows your face, and see what's any issues that are affecting them. In addition to that, you have the opportunity to stop out and engage with somebody in a non-law enforcement capacity, then you know you get to know them, you understand what their concerns are, and they also know you and are able to follow up with you and down the road. So I don't think Officer Hutton's here, but he's been great about getting out and engaging the community every opportunity he has. You can't really go through town without talking to somebody who knows Ryan or Officer Hutton or however they want to word them. So that's the big thing, is just getting out and being able to communicate with people and you know, make sure that there's a, they can relate your face in a time that isn't stressful to, so they know you when there is a time that is stressful.
And Officer Hutton was going to be on. He's on duty this morning, so I'm sure he's got something going on, but he might hop on later, so maybe folks will get to hear from him. But yeah, I think that's definitely a key part, is that engagement goes a long, long way. And that's something that I've heard all of you talk about, the things that you're doing, getting out and getting to know people. And then also not being right away into enforcement mode and some of those other resources that you provide. So maybe talk a little bit about that. I know you guys have some guides that talk about community resources for things that maybe you are the first ones on the scene, but it's not truly a law enforcement action, and some of those other things that you guys have to kind of facilitate them, even though you're not the experts in the area, but them getting help from other agencies and organizations.
Yeah, one partnership that we have is with IRLE Ball. They started a mobile crisis unit that affects central Iowa. So we have contacts with them. So if there's something, somebody needs assistance in a manner that's not necessarily law enforcement, whether it's a homeless person trying to find shelter for the evening or a family that just might need some how to proceed with a dispute or whatnot, we're able to call their dispatch number and then they send representatives to our location, whether they meet the family in the house or whether they come to the police department and meet with us there. But they're able to kind of take some of the responsibility for those events that aren't necessarily a criminal act, but they're able to facilitate the assistance that we might not be able to do, because they could transport to Des Moines, Ames, whatnot, when we might be in the city and not be able to leave since we're the only officer working.
And you talked a little bit about during the training and how you emphasize getting out and talking to the community and talking to people and getting to know people. What other types of tools and trainings do you have as a department that you go through, whether it be diversity training, you know, maybe it's de-escalating situations? Maybe talk a little bit about that.
So there's different ways of talking to different individuals, obviously, whether it's an adult or whether it's a child. We have to understand that everyone responds differently to how you. And then Sergeant Sis Media is he's a DRE, which is a drug recognition expert. So he's done trainings with us as far as how to expect somebody to respond, or what the type of behavior we typically see from an individual who might be impaired by this drug or this drug, and likely responses to our actions from that. So it's a good indicator for us as far as, you know, not everybody's gonna respond the same way, and substances might make somebody respond completely different based off of that too. So I know we do our SFST instruction at least annually, but then there's additional trainings throughout the year that we do, in which Sergeant Sis Media goes through those things as well.
And what does that stand for?
It's the standards field sobriety test. So for like an OWI testing, the DRE program is for impairment from a drug other than alcohol.
As far as, you know, you talked about bringing in Ireley Ball, are there other mental health first aid type trainings or things that you go through to recognize some of those signs of somebody that might be in a crisis?
We've gone through trainings with Mary Greeley as well, Story County. One thing our department has that I don't know how many officers in the state do, but most of us are EMTs. And if we're not certified as EMTs, we will be within the first year or so of employment. So that there's additional medical training for that and as far as how to respond. In addition, we've had parents of autistic children come in. That was within this last year. They came in and kind of discussed how their child responds to noises and lights and other stimuli and what's a good way to interact with their child, which if you talk to parents of autistic children, pretty much every child's going to respond a little bit, but there are some key things that are going to be more stressful for those children versus the others. So we're always trying to find a good speaker to come in and discuss those things with us. We try to host for our agency, but also countywide and statewide too. So
I think one of the things that is really important is I think the leadership starts at the top. I've been in this job for about 32 years now as a police officer, firefighter, and this last week, the director had a staff meeting and called all of the officers in, and we talked about the current climate in both law enforcement and awareness. We have minority officers and just some of their experiences. And I can tell you that's the first time in 30 plus years that I've ever done that. I thought it was very helpful to gain a perspective because we look at our coworkers and think, for instance, Officer Sabayi, we think, well, he's a great guy. He's probably never, ever been discriminated against. And to actually hear encounters from law enforcement against him in just simple things like a car accident, I thought that was very powerful. And so I think, again, it starts conversations at the top with leadership.
Before we move on, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And we're your hosts for this hour, Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. But before we move on to our next segment, I think we ought to hear from Shannon Novak. What's your reaction to that clip?
My reaction is like pretty in the middle. Like, I'm glad that they had that conversation because I think the conversation needs to be had about what steps are we actually taking? What are they actually doing behind the scenes to make sure they know what they're doing when they are going into situations where a person may not be mentally well. I do feel a little bit frustrated that it's taken this long for some of those things. Like the one man said it had been 30 plus years to see it done something like this. That's not have these types of conversations.
One of the things that was interesting to me was since this was on Facebook, there were Facebook responses. And there were three or four that were very laudatory. Oh, we're so lucky to have this kind of a police force in Nevada. And then the last one that I saw had things I can't read on the radio. So I realized that there are very different perceptions by the people of Nevada about the police force. So, you know, there's some people who know Officer Hutton by sight, but they particularly singled out this person as being somebody that everybody knew and was somebody you would trust and like. So I wondered, you know, it seems like they're two Nevadas. There's one police force, but they're two Nevadas.
Yeah, that's pretty true. And it kind of breaks down more into the money side. You know, you've got the people who have money and the people who don't. And the people who have money don't have to worry as much about, I don't want to say they don't have to worry about the police because that's not true, but the police are walking up to a middle-class suburban household completely differently than they're walking into a low-income trailer court where the roads aren't fixed and every single trailer is falling apart. They're walking into that trailer court differently. That's what I want them to address at this point is like, Nevada is mostly white, so I understand that these things that I'm talking about are happening to white people here, you know, like the police brutality and the bias of it all. And I think Nevada just needs to acknowledge that there's kind of a class system here that's not fully fair.
That was the point that you wanted to get across in the demonstration. Is that right?
No, that's what I wanted to get across right now with what I was talking about.
Okay. So hopefully you did get your point across. You felt that you had the chance to do that?
Yeah, I did. And, you know, I want to do more events like the conversation that we had in town. I want to keep opening up the conversation and keep kind of trying to get people active in the conversations, you know, like the one that I held, there was about 25 people there, give or take a few. So I'm hoping that the next one I plan, we can get, you know, 30 people there, give or take a few. And that number can keep rising.
Thank you very much.
We've just heard from Nevada citizen Shannon Novak, together with Nevada's mayor, Brett Barker, director of the fire and EMS, Ray Reynolds, Sergeant Chris Brands, and the public safety director, Ricardo Martinez, discussing policing on Nevada's monthly community coffee. And now it's time to talk about what's going on for the 4th of July in this year's COVID-19.
This is an unusual 4th of July. Usually we focus on Slater, which had always made the 4th of July their featured summer celebration with a big marching band, celebrity marchers. Last year it was Bernie Sanders. This year they didn't even answer my emails except to finally say, we'd like to skip the broadcast this year since things are scaled down so far. Even Ames is not having fireworks. Nevada is announcing that fireworks will be set off, but recommends that people watch from their cars. The one person who will be here to describe events in their town is Chris Blocker from the Boone Chamber of Commerce. Hello, Chris. What will be going on in Boone this weekend?
Hello, Susan. Thank you for having me. So we are going to have basically our original celebration like we always have. We will start with racing at the Boone Speedway. Hot laps will begin at 5 o'clock. They will follow with the Eve of Destruction and a car rollover. There will be an event that will take place with jumping of a bus or an RV. So that will be exciting. And then we'll follow up with the fireworks that will light off at 9:45 approximately. Of course, the Boone Speedway will be honoring all the CDC guidelines, following social distancing guidelines. They recommend that face masks be worn. And they're excited to have this great race event. They've been racing for the last few weeks, as you know, and had great attendance and a lot of cars. So they're excited for this 4th of July event.
So is there anything else happening in Boone?
That's it. That wraps up for basically the 4th of July festivities that will happen in Boone. As you know, our county fair is going to continue on as they had planned. All their events can be found on BooneCountyFairIA.com. It is to run July 16th through the 19th. And they too are excited. They will be having a carnival just as scheduled. And that will be, of course, ramping up a lot of cleaning and having a lot of stations for hand sanitizer once the kids get off. So a lot of additional measures have been taken in order to make that county fair a safe event. And then, of course, every Friday night and Sunday afternoon, Snooze Hill has live music out at the winery. They've seen some good crowds. So if you feel safe and would like to attend those events, they would welcome you. Seven Oaks Recreation is floating, tubing, kayaking, taking appointments just like always, sending people down the river, and it's going to be a nice hot weekend. So I would encourage you, if you're looking for something to do, to get out to Seven Oaks Recreation. The Iowa Arboretum is open to any visitors. So that public garden is a great attraction to be able to go out and see and smell those beautiful flowers and watch the trees and birds. And the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad is running their regular schedule, mostly regular. They have eliminated Mondays and Tuesdays, so running right now just Thursday through Sunday. And of course, doing the social distancing there as well. They continue to run their lunch trains and their dinner trains, so all that information can be found on their Facebook or their website and Facebook pages. And of course, the Boone Valley Brewery is open for customers, and our Ledges State Park has been extremely busy. So if you're looking to, you know, get out and hike this weekend or any time this summer, you know, they have been open and welcoming visitors, and we welcome any guests to come in to Boone County. Our four homes up there, cleaning measures as well to keep everyone safe. And so if you're looking for a good night's stay, you can stay at any of our four hotels. All that information can be found on visitboonecounty.com. And we just, you know, our motto right now is, you know, when you are ready, we have our doors wide open. So, you know, looking forward to getting some visitors and people back in the county and at all of our attractions.
Sounds like you have really been busy over in Boone, getting ready for people to try to be safe in the out of doors mostly, right?
Absolutely. You know, that's the thing we pride ourselves on, is that we do have a lot of outdoor recreation. And obviously in these times, outdoor recreation is good. And, you know, the weather is cooperating and is just a perfect time to be outdoors. You know, we have a great, we have some great campgrounds as well. You know, they are full, and occupancy has been basically filled since the pandemic hit. And then, you know, our two 18-hole golf courses, and then we have a 9-hole golf course over at Don Williams. So they continue to see a lot of traction and a lot of visitors that are coming to utilize that outdoor recreation opportunities.
Well, thank you so much for telling us what you're doing, not just this weekend, but there's still things going on this summer.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Susan.
Thanks for coming in.
Well, it sure sounds like there's plenty to do this weekend, or else there's always the chance to stay home, relax, and enjoy your own garden. And all the berries I know are coming ripe, as mine are this time of year. So
it's great to have to be able to go out in your garden if you have one. I don't have one anymore since I sold the house I'd lived in for 50 years. So that's probably why I noticed the story last week in the Des Moines Register about an unusual garden book by a woman who lives near Kelowna, Beth Cody. So I called her to find out what gardens she was talking about. And here's what she has to say and what her book's about. Hi, we have Beth Cody with us today, and you just wrote a book on Iowa Gardens of the Past, Lost and Historic Gardens of Iowa, 1850 to 1980. What made you interested in these gardens?
Well, hi, Susan. Thanks for having me on your show. Yes, I became interested in gardening when I moved out to my current property 10 or 12 years ago. And I also was very interested in garden books. I have many in my collection, and many of them are garden history books, which show beautiful pictures of gardens that were from the turn of the last century or from the 1920s or 30s. And they always looked so nostalgic and beautiful to me. But I noticed there never seemed to be any Iowa gardens included in any of those books. And so I started doing some research. I visited historical archives, the state historical libraries of Iowa, both in Iowa City and Des Moines, and various other museums and libraries across the state. And then I also looked online on eBay for postcards of Iowa gardens, and also digital online archives. And I found all kinds of beautiful pictures of Iowa gardens, and they were so interesting, and I wanted to find out more about the people who had made those gardens. So I started researching them online and using genealogy software, and also newspapers that I could find online, because some of them wrote stories about gardening. Actually, several of the gardens in my book still exist. It's tremendously rare for gardens to have a very long life. But Bruce Moore Gardens in Cedar Rapids is definitely still there. And that's a beautiful garden and maintained to the historical specifications that they were back in the day. Also, Terrace Hill had beautiful gardens there, and they've tried to restore some of those there too. So that garden still exists. And the Muscatine Art Museum, they have a Japanese garden from the 1930s that has been maintained. It was never paved over or anything. So those gardens I actually were able to see and stand where they were. The other ones I haven't been able to, although, well, when I did the research to find out more about the gardens, I wanted to make sure I knew exactly what the modern address of those gardens were. And so I could use Google Earth to go there. And also Google Street in many cases is available. So I could look at the garden from the street. So sometimes I could see the side yard and the front yard. And sometimes I could identify that there were still garden features standing that had been original from 100 years ago or even longer. That was really tremendously interesting as well. Obviously, when we got here and there was a prairie here, we had to learn how to garden in the conditions that we had. It's much colder than the eastern states in the United States. And so when people got here, they tried to grow apples and other kinds of fruits, but much of the time they would die over a winter. And we had a number of test winters there were certain years in the 19th century where they called them test winters because they were exceedingly cold. And, nursery men who had fruit trees, their stock would be wiped out in these exceptionally cold winters. And so there really was a terrible learning curve to try to figure out how to garden in such cold conditions that had never been tried before. They started the Iowa State Horticultural Society to try to pool their knowledge as to which trees would survive here on the prairie and which flowers. And of course, as time went on, they figured these things out. They figured which were hardy, and then more new plants were discovered, and then hybridizers came up with more varieties that would be slightly more cold hardy. And so now we have far more plants that can survive here, and we know that a great deal better than the people who were the first pioneers in Iowa.
Did you run across anything about the buck roses?
Well, yes, absolutely. I have a section in my book about Griffith Buck and the rose work that he did in hybridizing at Iowa State University. And he was one of our most famous plant breeders in the state, probably the most famous. And he was there, it was mostly in the 1950s and 60s and maybe the 70s that he did his work there. And a tremendously interesting story. He bred cold hardy roses, and not just cold hardy, but because his work that he was doing on the roses was not very well funded, he didn't have the money to spray the roses for diseases. And so only the ones that would survive without losing their leaves and could survive outside were the ones that would survive. And so he inadvertently bred for ones that, you know, were disease resistant, which was terribly rare in the 1950s and 60s because everybody sprayed their roses and cosseted them and did all kinds of things to get them through the winter. Now, of course, we don't like to spray all kinds of chemicals in our yards. And plus, we want ones that are hardy enough to survive without having to bury them under mounds of dirt or that sort of thing. So, his roses are greatly lauded now because not only are they resistant to diseases and cold hardy, but then they're they're beautiful, and many of them have lovely scent, and it's a great asset to our state's rose-growing ability.
I lived half a block from Griffith Buck for the last years of his life, like decades. We came in 1963.
I guess you remember seeing the roses in their yard, is that true?
Of course.
Well, we wouldn't have those roses today if he hadn't planted them in his yard and his wife hadn't continued to nurture them. And, you know, he had given them away to his friends as well and his relatives. But the university destroyed his breeding stock after he retired. And so that all would have been lost if it hadn't been for the ones that were planted outside the test fields. And it wasn't until the University, I think it was Minnesota, decided they wanted to collect those all again and test them and collate the which ones had still survived. And that's the reason we still have them and that they, you know, exist and they weren't lost forever.
When Beth Cody started talking about Griffith Buck, I wanted to tell her that I lived just half a block from his house, and I used to walk by the Buck's yard as more rose bushes were being planted. I saw how his wife Ruby cared for them until she was past 100 years old. I think she was getting help from her daughter Mary, who now lives in the Buck's house and continues to tend the garden. You were also Mary's neighbor, weren't you, Gina?
It was sure a treat, and it was sure beautiful to have that next door. They always had a little problem with the deer and little critters, so they had little fences. They had to protect them all.
But it was amazing to hear that basically when he died, that the only rose bushes were the ones he'd given away. I don't know whether they sold them much during his lifetime.
Beth Cody told me lots of interesting stories, and her book sounds beautiful, with many colored pictures and plans of gardens. In case listeners are interested in buying one, either for themselves or for their libraries, they should be warned it's not available in bookstores. You can get Iowa Gardens of the Past, Lost and Historic Gardens of Iowa, 1850 to 1980, at www.iowagardens.com.
And if you're interested in buying some buck roses, Larry Larson carries them down in the wonderful garden section of the Town and Country Market in Slater, Iowa, just right south of Ames. So if there's no 4th of July parade or events in Slater this year, it might be worth going down to Slater to shop for some flowering plants.
Yeah, I was surprised when I was looking at the Tri-County Times. There was an article about the Town and Country Market, and there was a big picture of a buck rose. I thought, that's part of our story. You can still get them. And Larry said there's only one nursery that still sells them, that he can get them, and that's down in Texas. But if you want to buy them here in Central Iowa, they have them at the Town and Country Market. I think it's about time to get a little special nostalgia from Paul Wearson.
Hello, Gina and Susan, are you there?
Hello, Paul.
Yes.
Good. Glad. Well, there's quite a mixture on the show today. You have controversy and up-to-date current events and gardening, and that's really appropriate things to have on the air today, Susan. A good show.
Thank you. Well, it's good to have you with us again, but I remember that the Slater 4th of July, I think I remember that from the first time that I went out with you when you were interviewing the mayors of Story County, and we got to Slater and you talked to the mayor of Slater about your memories of your cousin being an entertainer at the Slater 4th of July. And I thought,
it was
somebody in every town. Yeah,
that's right. Well, to Slater, when you think of Slater, you think of Howard Hammond, who was a lovely man. He was the man who was the keynoter and main spark for the Historical Society there. And Howard had joined us many times on KHOI in a lot of roles, and I really valued him. And it's sad that he passed away a time ago, but he was also mayor, I believe, of Slater. And when we did our road trips, that's how we got to know what goes on at Slater. And I had actually been there years ago because my nephew, Ray, he's an entertainer. He was going to be a professional singer, but thought, that's a rough life. So he went back to school. He became a budget director at Scott County and later chief executive there. But he still performs a lot at various organizations and conventions and things like that. And he and his son Scott do a lot of side things, singing and entertaining. And that one year, it happened to be that he was the main attraction at Slater. So I went down there, and I was really impressed by the length and breadth of the celebration at Slater. They had a big stage, and in the backdrop was a silhouette of the flag raising at Iwo Jima. And I was really impressed by the turnout and the obvious momentum it had, like it had been a tradition for years. And obviously, when you do that, you have an army of volunteers and the community steps forward. And I was really impressed by that, and I really felt that it was a bad news thing when I heard that they're not doing it this year due to the COVID-19. So many things are being canceled or changed. And the 4th of July, when you look at, and our road trips verified this, Susan, we have visited and promoted so many festivals in local communities. And when you do that, it takes such an army of volunteers and people involvement that very often communities that used to celebrate the 4th of July regularly have really not done that as much now because they have to gear up for the one festival they do during the year. Certainly at Story City, we don't do 4th of July because we do the big Scandinavian Days celebration on the first weekend of June. And so basically 4th of July doesn't really happen as a big event in Story City anymore. But it was, historically, before we did the festivals, big time in Story City, as it was everywhere. We have a lot of photographic evidence of large 4th of July parades in Story City. And this really goes back to the 20s and 30s. This area is honeycombed with artesian wells, free-flowing. It's wonderful water. If you could ever drink it, it's just pure and cold from deep in the earth. And one of the springs is located about a mile and a half from where I am now at my farm. And it was called Lake Comar. And it was a contraction of two names, Mr. Corneliuson and Mr. Marvick, did this big recreational area right out here in the middle of farms and fields. And the contraction of their names was Comar. So there was a lagoon where you could paddle in a canoe with your best friend. There was a swimming area. There was a 9-hole sand green golf course. There was an amphitheater. There was a skating rink, of course, concessions. It was a big time thing right out in the middle. And then, of course, now that's all relegated back to farmland. But in the 20s and 30s, on the 4th of July, there would be bumper to bumper traffic waiting to get in 2 miles back to Story City. And my dad and my mom were in the class of 24 and 25, respectively. And that was their big hangout as teenagers. And that continued until World War II. And so it was a large recreational area there. And their highlight in their whole history was the visit by Johnny Weissmuller, I think his name was. He played Tarzan in the movies in the 20s, you know, in the 30s. And he was an Olympic swimmer, and he was the main attraction at Lake Comar. And they also had an amphitheater there where traveling acting troops would go. And so basically you had all this recreation available at Lake Comar right in the middle of farm fields. And it was quite an enterprise. Of course, it was year-round because they had the lake would freeze in the winter, and they would have winter events out there too. So Lake Comar was just wonderful until World War II, and then eventually it devolved back into farmland. The only real remnant is a big copse of trees there, and I think they may have shut off the artesian well. But that was a real memorabilia of Story City, and especially the 4th of July celebrations. And I'm glad to hear it in your previous segment that they're doing things in Boone and other places that still observe the 4th of July. So it's alive and well, and I know when this pandemic passes that we'll be back to normalcy and celebrating our national birth.
And all those other festivals that we're missing out on this year. I remember, actually, I think what happened was that the towns staggered their holidays because they wanted out-of-town visitors. And in fact, I know Slater, this was a big reunion time. And I even heard about a house that had been owned by a large family, and they kept the house so that when they came back for the 4th of July, they could stay there. And I don't know whether
Well, of course, yeah. And you know, that's another thing about the festivals. The reunions take place there now, like at Scandinavian Day period. So when we come back here the first weekend of June, that's when all the old Story City and Rolling classes have their reunions. So it's an ideal time because it's a time to return to your roots and come back to your community. And there's the big festival, and then you have your class celebration too. And I'm sure that Slater, that's when they do that at the 4th of July, because that's their keynote celebration.
Yes, that's when they do that. And I see our time is just about up. So thanks for joining us.
Susan and Gina.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts for today, Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Other voices you heard were Chris Blocker, Shannon Novak, Brett Barker, Ray Reynolds, Sergeant Chris Brandes, and Public Safety Director Ricardo Martinez, as well as Ursula Rudenberg and Paul Wearson.
You can listen to today's local talk show and any of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with our relevant links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Iowa Band Law by Carl King, played by the Texas A&M Wind Ensemble.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878, or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. And I think some of you got some things in the mail, because when the post person comes in every day, our wonderful new woman post carrier, she brings us envelopes from you. So as they used to say on the old time radio, keep those cards and letters coming. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.